This Is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. You've heard the phrase war on poverty to describe LBJ's legislation to help the poor in the 1960s. But what about the war on apathy? This phrase was coined by Ned Cole, the son of an Irish immigrant raised in Hartford Southend and founder of the organization The Revitalization Corps. Today, we talk with author Andrew Carl about his book on coal, including Cole's fight to open up Connecticut's shoreline to everyone, especially minorities. The book is called Free the Beaches, the story of Ned Cole and the battle for America's most exclusive shoreline. Now, did you grow up with a summer home or cottage along Connecticut's shoreline? Do you remember the campaign to open up these beaches to non-residents? We want to hear from you this hour. Email where we live at WMPR.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. And coming up later, we'll also hear from a Hartford resident who was one of the city kids who rode buses to shore towns to protest these exclusive beaches with Cole and this group, the Revitalization Corps. But first, we want to learn more about how much of Connecticut's more than 200 miles of shoreline became private. Joining us from a studio at University of Virginia, again, is Andrew Carl, Associate Professor of History and African American Studies, also author of this book, Free the Beaches, the story of Ned Cole and the battle for America's most exclusive shoreline. He joins us today from a studio again at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So what drew you to focus in on this history of privatization on Connecticut's shoreline?
Yeah, I've always been interested in looking at the history of inequality and land use in America and understanding the sort of relationship between the two and also the sort of history of environmental injustice. And Ned Cole is a person who really sort of brought these issues into focus. And that was sort of what ultimately drew me to his story. And also just the sort of how captivating he was as an individual and how many sort of critical issues that his organization raised during that time.
Well, where did you grow up, Andrew? Is this something when you said you've always been interested in these issues, something that you noticed growing up?
You know, I grew up in Ohio, so far from the coast, but nevertheless had been always drawn to beaches and coastal areas as a particularly fragile environmental resource, but also one that has experienced profound change as a result of development. And also the kind of, you know, the tension between that desire for openness, the sense that beaches belong to everyone versus the reality, which is that in America today, many coastal areas are very exclusive and exclusionary to the general public.
So if we look at history, you know, when did this push for privatizing beach access in Connecticut and other places really take off?
You know, it began in Connecticut very early, and in many respects, Connecticut was sort of a trendsetter in the move toward privatizing shorelines. Really, in the early 1900s, you began to see the proliferation of private beach associations up and down the shorelines, and these are sort of a forerunner to the modern gated community in that they are sort of governed, have a sort of private form of governance, and also sort of privatized public space, namely their beaches. So that was, in a sense, a sort of a trend that we began to see spread across the U.S. Really in the post-World War II decades, but in Connecticut it began much earlier in the early 20th century.
Here in Connecticut, many of us are familiar with the term Gold Coast, and we'll be talking more about that part of the state in a little bit. But when we look at the people that were part of these beach associations, they weren't all the super wealthy, were they?
No, not at all. I mean, that was actually the model that sort of was developed in the early 20th century was one that would sort of had prefabricated communities that would really allow for, say, middle class white families to be able to own a second home. Many of these beach associations, especially in the eastern half of the state, were often identified with either religious or ethnic groups. There's the Irish beach, the Italian beach, the Jewish beach. But, you know, this is, so in a sense, it was not all very super wealthy folks, but it was also very exclusionary. All of these beach associations invariably were governed by racial covenants that barred the sale of lots to African Americans. So, you know, even though it was these were not all, you know, very wealthy communities, they were ones that were very much off limits to a segment of the state's population.
And when we look at Connecticut's coast, we're looking at more than 200 miles of shoreline. But how much of that was actually open to anyone, Andrew?
You know, less than around 7 miles of it was considered generally open to the public, and the rest was either in the hands of private homeowners or were public beaches that were really public in name only. Many communities restricted their public beaches to residents only or placed severe restrictions on the ability of non-residents to be able to actually access them. So as a result, by the time you get to the 1960s and 70s, when my story really begins, there's very few places along the state shoreline that a person, say, living in Hartford or elsewhere in the state who wasn't fortunate enough to be able to own a home along the shore, there was very few places that they could actually go to enjoy the shoreline.
And you mentioned in your book these were the result of what's called exclusionary zoning, keeping certain people out of specific areas, beach associations and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, exclusionary zoning was really the sort of chief mechanism of segregation across the state and really throughout the Northeast. I mean, you have communities that often zoned land in a way that made it next to impossible for low-income people to live in their communities. I mean, in Greenwich, for instance, over one-third of the entire town was zoned at four-acre lots minimum, so that you had to have your house on a four-acre lot to be able to even live there. And this was a sort of pattern that we saw throughout the state, is that you had really areas of concentrated affluence that was kind of locked in, and as a result, people of modest means really had no ability to move into communities because of local zoning ordinances.
Before we learn more about Ned Cole, were there any other state residents or state officials that were bringing attention to some of the consequences of these restrictions, Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, you had both people who were calling, who were sounding the alarm on the environmental costs of shoreline overdevelopment and privatization. You had, the sort of rampant destruction of coastal wetlands that was occurring up into the 1960s. And you also had those who were sort of connecting this issue of exclusionary beaches to a broader set of exclusionary practices in schools and in housing markets. So even in the 1960s, you had early attempts to sort of use the issue of beach exclusion as an opening wedge in a larger battle against, say, school segregation and against exclusionary housing markets. But it was really not until the 1970s and with Ned Cole's campaigns that you really began to see this issue become a real lightning rod statewide.
This is Where We Live. With us from a studio at University of Virginia is Andrew Carl. He's an associate professor of history and African American studies and the author of this new book, Free the Beaches, The Story of Ned Cole and the Battle for America's Most Exclusive Shoreline. Now, if you have a home along the shore, if you remember growing up there as a child, we want to hear from you, especially if you remember the campaign to free the beaches, so to speak, to borrow from Andrew's book title. Andrew, tell us about Ned. So he grew up in Hartford, born to an Irish immigrant. What's his story?
Yeah, Ned grew up the sort of, the life of a sort of comfortable middle class white American living in post-war America. He went to Fairfield University, graduated with honors, and was sort of living the dream, at least as his parents envisioned. He returned to Hartford and got a job in the insurance industry. He was all sort of set to live that sort of middle class life of comfort. And then he made a very sharp detour. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about some of the, I guess, the factors that led him to that detour. So, his mother in the book you write, she always hoped that he would have a comfortable life working in the insurance industry. But when he went to Fairfield University, he started to meet some people who challenged the notions that he grew up with, one being an African-American professor?
Yeah, Walter Petrie, who was a professor at Fairfield and was also, he, as Ned described, really opened his eyes to the problem of racism in America and inequality. And he did so through taking groups of students down to Harlem and walking them through the neighborhood, getting them acquainted with the culture, with the the community, as well as the struggles, and got them to sort of see firsthand African-American life and culture and urban inequality, not just sort of, talking about it in a classroom. And I think that really stuck with Ned, the idea of sort of direct engagement, communication on a sort of interpersonal level, as opposed to sort of intellectualizing these problems.
And he went on to graduate from Fairfield and work in the insurance industry. But there was another point that made him kind of question what he was doing with his life, and that was when JFK was assassinated.
Yeah, I mean, John F. Kennedy was someone who was very influential to him. He really looked up to him, as, you know, again, as a sort of young Irish-American Catholic. And his death really sort of led Ned to sort of question what he was doing in life. And, you know, he had long been struck by that sort of call to service that Kennedy had issued with his inaugural address. And, you know, after his death, he began to ask himself what he was doing to help contribute to making this a more engaged, less cynical country. And that was when he decided to quit his job and start this sort of domestic peace corps, as he described it, called Revitalization Corps.
And we're going to learn more about the Revitalization Corps in just a little bit. But I'm curious, Andrew, what the reaction was of his family to this change in his life, especially his mother. You have an interesting anecdote in your book.
They were not too pleased, his mother in particular. I mean, again, she was someone who very much sort of wanted him to sort of live a very conventional life, and was horrified by his decision to, you know, quit a job, that, you know, very, you know, promising career, and start, you know, this sort of anti-poverty organization that was in particular addressing problems of racism and in seeking to engage and work with the city's African-American communities, to the point where she had concluded that he had literally sort of, you know, lost his mind. She actually had him committed to a state mental hospital after he had made this decision. That was how sort of fiercely opposed she was. And she actually blamed Walter Petrie, the professor who she thought had poisoned her son's mind in college, for his decision.
Much of the Connecticut shoreline was once off limits to people, unless you lived in a shore town or belonged to a beach association. Today, we're learning about the fight to open beaches to the public. Connecticut resident Ned Cole helped bring awareness to the issue, beginning in the 1960s. And our guest today is Andrew Carl, author of a new book called Free the Beaches, the story of Ned Cole and the battle for America's most exclusive shoreline. He joins us today from a studio at the University of Virginia. Up next, we're going to learn more about how Cole's campaign was received by shore towns. Do you remember the fight to open up Connecticut's beaches? Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalbathanchel. We're learning about Ned Cole, a Connecticut resident and anti-poverty activist that worked to make Connecticut's shoreline accessible to all. Author Andrew Carl documents his efforts in his new book, Free the Beaches, the story of Ned Cole and the battle for America's most exclusive shoreline. Andrew's joining us from the studio at University of Virginia in Charlottesville. And there's an excerpt of his book on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. Andrew, we were talking about Ned Cole leaving this his career of working in insurance to form the Revitalization Corps, similar to the Peace Corps. But talk us through how he went about doing that and getting people to buy into what he was the message that he was trying to relay.
Yeah, I mean, as you said at the outset, I mean, he was very much focused on waging a war on apathy, in particular waging that in the suburbs, you know, amongst the middle class whites and, you know, in West Hartford and other suburbs that had sort of really left the city and, as he saw it, abandoned its African-American community and Puerto Rican communities. And he really wanted to sort of engage with them and sort of find ways to sort of build bridges of communication that could combat the sort of vicious, cancerous stereotypes that many suburban whites had of urban America, and particularly of African-American communities.
And he started by opening up an office. And what about the, I guess, the connection to Harlem when he would go there? So did he start in Harlem and then work in Hartford?
Yeah, so he, you know, he started by opening up a storefront in Hartford, and he put in, you know, he put classifieds in the newspaper calling on folks to volunteer their time. You know, he said, you know, just 3 hours a week, either tutoring, working on helping young African-American men find jobs, a variety of activities. So it was very much sort of the moment, trying to respond to immediate needs. But then he also, it began to grow rapidly. You know, many national publications began to write stories on Revitalization Corps, and chapters began to spread across. Soon he opened up a chapter in Harlem, that he sort of spent many years going back and forth between Hartford and Harlem. But then others who were inspired by his call to service opened up their own chapters on college campuses and in cities ranging from Miami, Florida, all the way out to Watts, L.A.
Well, how did African-Americans look at Ned Cole and think, you know, who is this guy coming into our neighborhoods? And I'm curious, you mentioned he was trying to reach out to whites in places like West Hartford. Were they skeptical?
Yeah, I mean, initially, there was a lot of skepticism as to what Ned was doing in on the north end of Hartford. I mean, but I think, you know, he really was able to win the confidence and affection, really, of many in the community just by being himself and really spending time getting to know people in a sort of, you know, sincere manner. You know, he really didn't come in with any agenda or any assumptions, but really just spent a lot of time listening, engaging, you know, sort of rapping with folks on the street, in barbershops, in their homes, and also really expecting the same of the suburban whites who volunteered with Revitalization Corps. You know, the families who were who participated in this were expected to go into the north end of Hartford, get to meet family, African-American families in their homes, as opposed to just simply having them come to the suburbs. So it was very much about sort of breaking down these divisions on a sort of interpersonal level.
Meanwhile, there's a lot of unrest happening in U.S. cities, also here in Hartford, with how African-Americans were treated, where they were subjected to live. Can you walk us through some of how that unrest helped fuel some of the activism and why people wanted to follow Ned Cole and into this group?
Yeah, I mean, this is, as you probably know, I mean, many of the listeners know, you know, the 1960s and the summers in the 1960s were a particular time of racial unrest in American cities. Hartford, in particular, was racked by an uprising often referred to as a riot in the summer of 67, Harlem in 1964. And this was a time in particular, and this is kind of how Ned also kind of gravitated toward the issue of recreational inequality. Many of these incidents were sparked by conflicts over outdoor recreational space. But also, you know, as he saw, underlying many of the grievances of African-American communities was this issue of recreational deprivation. The fact that you know, public officials didn't seem to care about the fact that many inner city children lacked safe places to play. In Hartford in particular, there was a shockingly high number of drowning deaths of black youth in the city, in particular along a stretch of the Park River that was close to two housing projects. And the sort of response of public officials was complete indifference. And this was something that really was one of the sort of issues that was fueling unrest, and ultimately the Kerner Commission that, you know, issued its report in 1968 identified recreational inequality as one of the sort of high levels of grievance that was common across many of the riot-torn cities in America.
You mentioned the Kerner Commission. This was the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders, the Kerner Commission releasing this report on urban violence in 1968. So when that report came out, I mean, if Ned Cole wasn't there with his group, the Revitalization Corps, again, bringing awareness to the disparities, is this something that would have just been buried?
You know, I mean, you know, Ned was someone who sort of thought that the Kerner Commission report should be read by every American. I mean, you know, he thought that this should be gospel, you know, that this would be something that would help sort of awaken, in particular, those suburban white families who had seemed to sort of become cold and indifferent to the problems of urban America, that by reading that and understanding the lessons of it, we could begin to work towards solutions. So he really was proselytized on the importance of the Kerner Commission and what its findings really said to all America.
He was encouraging the armchair activists to actually do something and not just talk about it in their homes and with the people they know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as he described himself, he was someone who believed in gut liberalism, not the sort of kind that, you know, you would see happen in a college classroom or, result in position papers or other sort of statements. It was manifest through action. And it came from the gut. It came from instinct. And that was something that sort of guided him throughout this time period, was the idea that, you know, we don't have time to sit around and talk about these issues. We need to sort of engage on a direct level and help improve people's lives and work toward a better country.
Now, how did Ned Cole gravitate toward beach access from spending time, again, highlighting the disparities and the issues of poverty within neighborhoods and cities?
Yeah, I mean, it was really, in a sense, almost by accident. I mean, you know, as one of the many initiatives that Revitalization Corps was leading was one that was aimed at sort of providing summer recreational options for African-American children living on the north end of Hartford. And one of the sort of ideas that he came up with was to rent a van and bring a group of kids down to the shoreline. He didn't think of this as a protest at all. He just thought that this would be a good, you know, activity. And many of the African-American mothers who were critical in the work that Revitalization Corps did were very strongly in support of it as well. You know, they wanted to see their children get these type of, you know, enrichment activities and the types of recreation that the rest of Americans seem to sort of, you know, consider a sort of right of childhood. And so they sort of, you know, started this initiative to start, you know, sending children to the shore. But when they got there, they discovered that there was nowhere they could go.
Because there were so many private areas due to beach associations that had been formed along these shore towns?
Yeah, exactly. And even the public beaches, with the exception of the state beaches at Hammonasset, you know, really, you know, there were very few places that were open to the general public. And also he really wanted to sort of engage with the folks who lived and vacationed along the shoreline. He envisioned, you know, sort of had a very rosy image of white and black children playing together and white and black parents talking and realizing their common humanity and finding sort of ways to begin to break down those stereotypes. He thought that leisure spaces and leisure activities could actually be a vehicle for building a more integrated society. But as he discovered, the white folks who lived along these shorelines were not interested in that at all. In fact, you know, they were not greeted warmly at all.
Andrew Carl, Associate Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Virginia, author of the new book, Free the Beaches, The Story of Ned Cole and the Battle for America's Most Exclusive Shoreline. An excerpt of that book's on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. If you want to join the conversation, if you remember growing up on the beach, or if you remember Ned Cole, a very controversial figure in the 60s and 70s, we should say that he wasn't able to join us due to health issues. Ned Cole. But Andrew, we're talking through your book that you did a lot of research on what led Ned Cole to try to free the beaches and raise awareness. So I'm curious if you could walk us through some of the first incidents when he rented the buses and went to a particular beach in Old Lyme, for example.
Yeah, and he became really radicalized on this issue after a particularly negative incident in Old Lyme in the summer of 1971 when they came to one of the private beaches along the shoreline and were, you know, received very, you know, hostile reactions from residents, racist sort of epithets being thrown at the parents and children. And at that moment, he really was, you know, it opened his eyes to the extent of the problem and of the sort of pervasive racism among many of the families who lived along the shore. And at that point, he began to realize this issue of beach access was about more than just the beach itself. In fact, it was very much a kind of issue about the public's right to public space and about the sort of structural barriers that had been sort of put up along the shoreline and throughout society that prevented African Americans from freely participating in these sort of, you know, things that money Americans also enjoyed.
This is all going on in Connecticut, but there's also a push in other states to open up access. Can you walk us through a little bit of what was happening elsewhere, Andrew?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is coinciding with a sort of open beaches movement that is spreading across coastal America in response to the sort of, you know, the problem of privatization and the diminished access to the general public, also the overdevelopment and environmental degradation of shorelines, all sort of led to this the flowering of movements that were very local, but also kind of eventually became national toward restoring the public's right to its shorelines, which is a sort of ancient right that goes back all the way to the Roman Empire, and one that is sort of a part of American common law that is that states that, you know, the foreshore is public land, and you know, the public has a right to enjoy and access it. And so, you know, this all, but as Americans began to see that right slipping out of their grasp, there were concerted efforts to both fight in the courts and on the beaches toward restoring that right.
You were talking about the right to this space. So from the water to the high tide mark, is that an area that was always considered public? But if you weren't part of these associations or town residents, you weren't able to even access that area?
Yeah, I mean, that's the sort of the problem in Connecticut in particular. Is, yes, legally, the wet sand portion of the shoreline is public land, but if there's no way to get to it by land, then, you know, you really don't sort of enjoy that right. And so that was, you know, an issue that Ned also was calling attention to, was the fact that, you know, we were being denied, the general public was being denied its right to this space that belonged to everyone. And this was, again, a sort of, you know, something that many others in other parts of the country were also calling attention to, usually, you know, again, in response to the overdevelopment and privatization of beaches.
And when you write in your book, whenever there were efforts to whether to pass legislation to protect the coast or to maybe make the local autonomy less strict, there was a big backlash. So politicians weren't getting anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I think I discovered in the course of doing research for this, was how privatization and the sort of exclusionary culture that we began to, you know, you saw in many of these communities was not just sort of antisocial and wasn't just sort of, you know, didn't just have effects on, you know, on society, but was also environmentally destructive because it resulted in measures that were often, you know, very damaging to the shoreline itself, and also, you know, sort of led to the a sort of political culture that was resistant to regulation out of fear that, you know, sort of regulatory bodies, whether they be state or federal, might undermine the ability of private homeowners or beach communities to restrict access. And so as a result, you began to see sort of a kind of efforts to really sort of either prevent legislation or really sort of gut regulatory agencies' ability to manage shorelines in the interest of environmental protection and in the interest of the public.
When we talk about the environment, not to understate, but there were, and you write in your book, by the mid-1960s, there were 26,000 acres of wetlands. Half of them were gone because of this overdevelopment and no restrictions on what was being built.
Yeah, and this is very much a sort of a byproduct of the the system of government in Connecticut, which really gave a lot of autonomy to local municipalities, was very resistant to coordination amongst cities and towns. You know, as many listeners might know, in 1960, the state abolished county governments. So, I mean, you really had a kind of very highly fragmented, localized political culture in the state that made it all the more difficult to come up with solutions that were in the interest both of, you know, the shoreline itself as well as the general public.
You're talking about the Home Rule Act. We're still talking about that in Connecticut today with efforts to regionalize towns and municipalities kind of putting their heads in the sand when it comes to thinking about better ways to have government and share resources. But Ned Cole, again, he was a figure that, you know, some people loved him, but a lot of people hated him. What about his personality, Andrew, that got under people's skin?
Yeah, I mean, he was someone who was very controversial, and someone who was really fearless in his protest tactics. I mean, he engaged in a whole variety of very inventive forms of protest, as well as, you know, was very sort of quick-witted and had, you know, great, you know, as one reporter described him, as a human quote machine, because he was just so good at sort of, you know, really capturing issues and drawing public attention to not just the issue of beach access, but a whole variety of sort of injustices in the state. And so that was something I think that, you know, but really, you know, and he was not afraid to sort of take on communities. And I think in that respect, as he became increasingly outraged over the exclusionary practices of shoreline towns. He really sort of went after these communities directly and challenged them to sort of live up to their own ideals, and also really challenged their right to sort of hoard these natural resources. But, you know, and did so in a way that I think many said that perhaps he was generating more heat than light on this issue.
Ned Cole tried to run for office, first congressional district, and he was an outsider. The Democrats didn't want anything to do with him, so he tried to run as an independent. And later, he tried to run for president.
Yes, except despite being only 32 years old at the time and unable to actually hold the office, he was able to get onto the New Hampshire Democratic primary ballot and into a nationally televised debate against the major candidates in 1972.
Before we take some calls, I had mentioned politicians not getting anywhere with trying to figure out a way to open up beach access, but also to placate the concerns of these property owners that lived in these towns and felt like these beaches were something that they worked hard for in the town, paid for the taxes, paid to take care of them. They should be able to restrict access. Governor Ella Grasso, for one, did a beach tour. And what were some of the things that she told people?
You know, Ella Grasso was a very savvy politician, and she, you know, but she came into office at the time when this issue was really, at its sort of peak. And, Ned Cole really sort of, challenged her directly to live up to some of her, to actually sort of speak to her constituents, in particular, many of those who were not fortunate enough to own a house along the shoreline. And many, many whites in Connecticut were also very, were increasingly sort of outraged over the fact that there was very few places along the shore that they could access as well. And so she tried to sort of show that she was concerned about this. She tried to really sort of work with Ned. In fact, actually, she appointed him as an unpaid advisor to the governor's office for a period in the late 70s. But at the same time, when it came down to it, she was very resistant to the idea of challenging the rights of private beach associations and of shoreline property owners, and ultimately just tried to sort of work around the edges, trying to find ways to acquire undeveloped land along the shoreline and maybe create more public, state beaches. But as she soon discovered, there was very little land left to acquire. So she was someone who tried to sort of delicately dance around this issue. And as a result, Ned then came after her and sort of, called her out for her inaction.
This is Where We Live. Andrew Carl is an associate professor of history at the University of Virginia and African American Studies as well, author of the new book, Free the Beaches, the story of Ned Cole and the battle for America's most exclusive shoreline. Mwakil's calling with a question from New London. Mwakil, go ahead.
I live in New London. There was a beach called Butler Beach. It was right in back of, and it's still there, right in back of the Coast Guard Academy, where Mike Pence gave a commencement speech yesterday. And back in the 60s, that beach, the Ocean Beach in the city, had a de facto segregation policy. And blacks started to migrate to this beach, okay? My question is, were there any other segregated beaches by race in Connecticut or in other parts of the country?
Thank you for your call, Mwakil. Go ahead, Andrew.
Yeah, I mean, shorelines and beaches across the U.S. were either explicitly or informally segregated throughout the first half of the 20th century. My first book actually is a history of African American beaches in the South, and sort of looks at the sort of ways in which African Americans sought to circumvent Jim Crow through carving out their own spaces. And it sounds like here in New London, we had a sort of similar example of that. But in Connecticut in particular, you really had a sort of form of racial segregation through both privatization and then the kind of selective enforcement of these sort of private act, private property laws. So, one of the things that I discovered was that, African Americans, say, living in cities like New Haven and elsewhere, soon discovered, early in life that, beaches, while they were not sort of, explicitly segregated by race, were often informally segregated, and they learned where they were welcome and where they were not welcome. And also, I sort of use an example from the civil rights icon, Constance Baker Motley, who grew up in New Haven, and she when asked to describe the sort of first time she really encountered racism as a youth, she said that it happened on the state shoreline when she accompanied two white friends of hers to a beach in Milford. And this was technically a private beach, but her white friends had always been able to go there without any problems. No one asked them for a beach pass. But yet the first time that she accompanied them, suddenly they were stopped at the gate and there was a membership requirement. And I think that was kind of indicative of the ways that segregation worked in the North.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're talking with Andrew Carl, author of the new book, Free the Beaches, the story of Ned Cole and the battle for America's most exclusive shoreline. Again, an excerpt of his book is on our website, WMPR.org/where we live. Up next, one of those kids from Hartford who went on these beach trips with Ned Cole is now a father and business owner. He'll tell us what he remembers about Ned Cole and what it was like to show up in a place where he wasn't welcome. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Just last week, we did a show on the lack of swimming pools in urban areas and how historically in this country, minorities were kept from accessing them in the 20th century. Now, some states are fortunate to have access to water, like Connecticut's beautiful shoreline. But just because there were beaches didn't mean everyone was welcome to use them. And just a little bit, we're going to hear from a Hartford resident who remembers Ned Cole and still talks with him today. Before that, we get to Liebert Fitzgerald Lester II. I want to take a quick call. Becca calling from Brantford. Becca, what's your comment or question?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I grew up on the shoreline in Connecticut on a very sort of exclusive and private beach. There were only a handful of houses that had access to that beach. And I think my brother and I, you know, even as kids, had a sense of what a privilege that was and what a, you know, that it was unfair, frankly, that we had access, not just, you know, to a place to play, but the calming effect of being that close to the water is, as anybody who's spent some time in the water or looking out over the horizon knows, it's really, I think, emotionally an incredible asset. My brother now works in San Francisco for an organization called City Surf Project, and they take kids from public schools and bring them to the beach and teach them how to swim and surf, and they actually train some of the students to teach other students. And I think in California, even he was struck. I think in California, the beaches are supposed to be protected as public space. But he remarked, I remember when he first started working there, that a lot of the kids, they're mostly Latino and Black and first-generation Americans. A lot of the kids didn't even know they were allowed to go to the beaches. Mm-hmm. And that's a state that, you know, has made some, I believe, some effort to keep the beaches open to all. But there's, you know, there are a lot of barriers in addition to the space just, you know, in Connecticut, a lot mm-hmm. of the beaches being private. There are, even in California, access issues, just perception issues.
Well, thank you, Becca, for your call again from Brantford. I want to ask Liebert Fitzgerald Lester II, owner of It's a G-Thang Barber Salon and Spa in Hartford. Thank you for coming back on the show, Liebert. You remember Ned Cole as a kid. You went on some of those bus trips.
Yes, we went on numerous bus trips. You know, Ned took us to the beach. You know, prior to that, we had never seen a beach probably other than on television. And, you know, so we went on a lot of trips with Ned because the people in the community, I don't know if they would remember the name Revitalization Corps, but we called it 2550 because that was the address where we would go and say, where are you going? Oh, I'm going to 2550. Because Ned, he always had activities. He introduced us to UConn, in which he paired us with tutors who would help us with our schoolwork. And, you know, if you had problems with your reading, your writing, your math, you know, he always had something for us. And then, you know, we weren't aware that the things that he was doing was controversial because Ned, he made everything seem so simple.
How did the white children react when you came on one of their beaches?
Well, the most memorable thing that I remember from being on a beach was we went to the beach, and there were just white people out there. And we looked at it as just white people. But then when we actually went onto the beach, we arrived and we got onto the beach, there were some white boys that were building a sandcastle. And so I wanted to build a sandcastle too. And so when I went there with the little white boys, they rejected me. They didn't allow me to build the castle with them. So I left and I just started digging, building my own castle. I'm like, okay, cool, no problem. And then I noticed there was a little white girl. She went to build with the white boys, and they rejected her as well. But then she saw me build, and she came over to where I was. And so I'm like, okay, some help. You know, a girl, cool. You know, we're going to build a sandcastle. And so we're building. I don't know how long we were working on the castle, but then I know I looked up. The dad came. I guess he grabbed it, and he snatched her arm and pulled her away. And I looked, you know, as a little kid, you know, I didn't understand what was happening. And she returned. And she returned, and, you know, we're still working on a castle. And she asked me, why don't I just go into the water and just wash it off? Mm-hmm. And I was like, wash off what? I didn't know what she was talking about. Mm-hmm. And so then I guess her dad came and got her again. And she went away. And then getting older and then, you know, becoming knowledgeable about racism and all of those things, I realized that what she was talking about wash off was the dirt, the dirt on my skin. Because mm-hmm. she was like, you know, the dirt. But when she said the dirt, I was thinking of the sand that was on my hands, you know, mm-hmm. just wash it off. And I'm saying to myself, if we're building, why would I wash it off? Because you got to go get water, you got to dig in the sand. And so I'm like, if she's going to be trying to keep her hands clean, you can't build a castle. But, you know, her dad, the second time he took her away, she never came back. And, you know, when I talked to Andrew, that's when I really began to think about that, because he was telling me that he was doing a book on Ned and about the beaches. And so when I reflected upon it, I was like, wow, that was really significant. The fact that she didn't know that, you know, my blackness couldn't, you can't wash it off. Yeah.
Andrew Carl is with us from the University of Virginia, author of this book, Free the Beaches, the story of Ned Cole and the battle for America's most exclusive shoreline. So while Ned and the RC and little kids like Liebert were trying to raise awareness by visiting these beaches as a protest, this was also making its way through the courts. And was there any success in opening the beaches for people in Connecticut?
Well, not during the time when Ned was most active on the issue. It didn't come until 2001, and it was as a result of a lawsuit filed by a law student named Brendan Layden, who was stopped when trying to jog through Greenwich's beach, and because he was a non-resident, and they said that, you know, non-residents were not allowed on the shoreline, and he decided to sue the town, challenging the constitutionality, both on the grounds of the public trust doctrine that, you know, states that the shoreline is public property, but also on the basis of free speech rights, that they were restricting his right to free speech and association. So that worked its way through the courts in the late 1990s, and ultimately the Connecticut Supreme Court ruled in 2001 that towns like Greenwich could not restrict public beaches to residents only.
Now, because they couldn't restrict them, shore towns, other places, especially Greenwich, found different ways to try to restrict non-residents. What were some of those tactics?
Yeah, I mean, they really sort of resisted and sought to undermine the spirit of that decision ever since, and continue to do so, either through removing public parking spaces or making parking lots near the shoreline open to residents only, putting in place a whole cumbersome set of requirements in order to purchase a beach pass. So, for instance, in Greenwich, you know, to buy a beach pass, you have to go to the opposite side of the town in some city office building that's not even open on the weekends in order to buy a beach pass. I mean, really putting in place just a number of hoops that are all meant to sort of dissuade, and if not make it, you know, practically impossible for outsiders to get in.
What is Ned Cole's legacy today, Andrew? And I'll ask that of our guest, Liebert, as well. First, Andrew.
Well, I think, you know, the legacy is one, you know, you can see it in the lives of people like Liebert and many others who are really touched and really affected by the work that he did in the community. I would say also, you know, on the issue of his activism, I think it's a cautionary tale for, you know, the need for activists to form partnerships and collaborate and form coalitions and not sort of allow, a sort of issue or a movement to become too reliant on one individual. Because, you know, Ned sort of, you know, he marched to the beat of his own drum often, and he sort of resisted the kind of sort of, you know, building coalitions with other groups and organizations to the point when his health began to suffer in the 1980s, when he sort of, you know, reached retirement years, it was difficult to sort of continue the work of Revitalization Corps as a result.
Lieber, you're still friends with Ned today. Tell us about his legacy, what it means to you.
Well, Ned, he frequents the barbershop. He calls me all the time, and when you speak to Ned, he still has the fire of the past, and he tells me, oh, you got to be a leader. You guys have to stand up, and he he addresses all of the issues. And, you know, he's talking about Donald Trump trying to turn back the clock, and he's saying to me, you know, you need to lead the people. You got to stand up. You remember the things that we used to do? And I was like, Ned, I'm like, you should be relaxing now. You know, he'll come up. Like, Ned calls me all the time. But Ned had a profound impact on the community. Everyone, you know, they say a lot of things about the north end of the city. But everyone knows Ned. Ned come to the barbershop on the bus, and Ned would just take a walk. You know, he would walk up Nelson, go around down Barber, come back down Westland, and come to the barbershop. And he said he wants to see what's going on. And those are a lot of the areas where people say, oh, my God, you know, he's over there, you know. And I'm like, people are like, man, that's Ned. And, you know, people are saying, like, you know, the little kids are saying, like, well, who is Ned? And, like our children in the community, they don't know Ned, but everyone knows Ned. So Ned is like a fixture in the community. Everybody remembers Ned. Remember Ned putting pressure on Kmart till we got a tractor trailer load of toys so that for Christmas, everyone, you know, had new toys. Ned had clothes. Ned had food. I mean, Ned did so much in the community. And, you know, you would go places like the racism was everywhere. But then you see Ned. Ned was a white man, and Ned was doing all of these good things. And so you would look at it like, say, okay, what's the difference between Ned, white guy, and then this other white guy? Ned sees us as being human. Ned sees that, you know, we should have access to certain things. And Ned was genuine in his help to help us. So, I mean, his legacy will live because, you know, he had some conflict with the Hartford Courant. He calls me anytime. He always wants something done. It's like, gee, he calls me G. He's like, gee, I need you to get on top of this. We got to put pressure on the Courant. They're not doing this. They're not doing that. Or, I mean, it's always something.
He's an activist to this day.
Yes, he's an activist to this day.
And we should mention again that Ned wasn't able to join us because of his health issues, but his impact lives on, and you still talk with him.
Yes. I was just calling people and texting people. I said, listen, we're talking about Ned. I said, I need you guys to call NPR. And then, you know, sending back, oh, I'm at work. I'm, you know, blah, blah, blah. They can't call in or whatever. But Ned did so much. Because like I said, what he did with the tutorial program with UConn, that had a profound impact on the kids. Because every Tuesday, a busload of kids would come in from UConn, and they would tutor us. And then one Saturday a month, we would go to UConn and just hang out with your tutor, see the college campus, and all of those things. So he was introducing us to things that we wouldn't normally see. And like Miss Linda, my brother Ricky and I, if you remember us, Miss Linda, you're from Bolton. We had been looking for you. You know, the two little black boys from Hartford, Connecticut. And my brother's in Atlanta, and we were talking about Miss Linda. Because we were able to go. She took us fishing, and we would go over there for the weekend. You know, so Ned did a lot of profound things.
Liebert Fitzgerald Lester II, owner of It's a G-Thang Barber Salon and Spa in Hartford, thank you for coming on and telling us about your memories of Ned and how you're still friends today.
Thank you for having me.
Also, Andrew Carl, who's the author of this new book, Free the Beaches, the story of Ned Cole and the battle for America's most exclusive shoreline. We thank you for joining us, Andrew.
Oh, thank you so much.
Today's show produced by Lydia Brown. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.